Before we start, I should say that there's on Friday, this Friday, the 17th at 2 o'clock, a lecture in OCHS Library by Ted Proferris on the Poetics of Sovereignty in Early Vedic Liturgies. That's the title, The Poetics of Sovereignty in Early Vedic Liturgies. And he's an expert on the Mimamsa that I'll be speaking about briefly today. From the School of Oriental and African Studies in London. And he's an excellent speaker, and I urge you all to go along to it, really. I think you'd all enjoy it. So I'm going to leave you with a poster, just to remind you. I don't think I've got enough to go around, but if you want one, do hang on to it. If not, then just leave it behind. So do come on to Ted Proferis at 2 on Friday. Today we're speaking... Well, there's a change of plans. I was going to talk about... I think on the schedule it says ritual traditions and bhakti. And then next week, sant tradition. I've decided to slightly rearrange things and today talk about Vedanta, the Vedanta tradition, particularly Shankara, because I noticed that we had missed him out and he's so important in the history of Indian Hindu thinking. And then next time we go on to Shaiva and Vaishnava tantric traditions in more detail. So we'll spend 3 weeks on the Shaiva and Pancharatra traditions after looking at the Vedanta today. So I think it makes it slightly more coherent and it'll enable us to go into more depth with particular traditions in the last 3 weeks, which we haven't done up till now. So up to now it's more survey kind of work. So today I want to look at the Vedanta tradition briefly, and particularly at Shankara. I apologise for the lack of diacritical marks on the handout, but I haven't been able to get them on my computer yet. They were on my old one, but that broke, so I haven't been able to get them on the new one yet. Now, the Vedanta tradition, the Vedanta means the end of the Veda, and what we notice about this tradition is the importance of text and interpretation in the Brahmanical tradition. And the emphasis is on what is old. It's you shouldn't have any new ideas, but you have to... Any new ideas you have to actually say that they're very old ideas, or you have to interpret the texts in a certain way to present your ideas through the lens of the texts. So non-originality is a hallmark of, well, most... on Indian traditions. And well, and I don't really mean that. I mean that the claim to non-originality is a hallmark of these traditions. They are innovative and they are do offer new insights and new understandings, but they always couch it in terms of what is old and what is ancient. And that's managed through a number of interpretative strategies, such as grammar, understanding, particular interpretations of grammar, of Sanskrit grammar, which... or getting meanings out of a text, which you could read it in that way, but the sort of common sense way would be to read it in another way, but the Sanskrit allows some words to go with other words, which would normally not be the case. But so you can interpret text in certain ways. And there's also things like nirukta, which is the interpretation of meanings, etymology. It's not scientific etymology, but... traditional etymology of words. So it's another way in which these non-originality, if you like, is managed in this material. Okay, so that's two characteristics. The importance of text, or three characteristics, the emphasis on the old. The third characteristic of these traditions is liberation is the stated goal of these traditions, the idea of liberation from the cycle of birth and death. So soteriology is the goal of these philosophical inquiries. And to understand soteriology in Indian traditions, we really do need to look at Vedanta, although that wasn't originally my plan to do that, but I think we should do that. Now, the background toward the Vedanta, then, means the end of the Veda. So the Upanishads are called the Vedanta, the end of the Veda. And the Vedanta tradition develops out of the Upanishadic tradition. Terms which are particularly important in the philosophical discourse here, non-dualism, Advaita, and dualism, Advaita. The earlier Upanishads are non-dualistic on the whole, which means that they posit a unitary substance in the universe, which sustains the universe and which sustains the self and all beings within it. So there's that idea which occurs in the earlier Upanishads, which I'll be speaking about presently. And the Vedanta initially comprises two traditions. There's one is called the Mimamsa, and the other is called the Vedanta. Now, another two terms are used: the Purva Mimamsa, the original or first Mimamsa, and the Uttara Mimamsa, which is synonymous with the Vedanta tradition. So the Purva Mimamsa and the Uttara Mimamsa are really the Vedanta, in other words, the Vedanta tradition. And Mimamsa means exegesis or interpretation of exegesis of the Vedic scriptures. And there's an exegetical continuity between these two forms of Mimamsa, between the later Mimamsa or the Vedanta and the Uttara Mimamsa. And the Purva Mimamsa. There's a continuity of textual tradition and commentary. Now both are atheistic as well. The Purva Mimamsa is atheistic. It posits that the Veda has no author and is eternal, has no beginning and will have no end, and has been received by the ancient seers as radio receivers, as radios receive waves, so the Vedic seers received the Veda and communicated it to the human community. But it has no author, it's authorless. And the Mimamsa, the Purva Mimamsa, is an atheistic tradition. There's no creator God, there's no theos in that tradition. And then the Advaita Vedanta, as we'll see, is also atheistic in the sense that Shankara doesn't posit a theos as an ultimate reality. But as a kind of quality, but later Vedanta traditions were clearly theistic, as we'll see. But the early Vedanta is atheistic in that sense. Now the Purva Mimamsa has its origin in the sutras, the Purva Mimamsa sutras of Jaimini, whose dates are about 200 BC. And the opening verses of that text are now the inquiry into Dharma, Atato Dharma Jignasa. And you'll remember that is the same pattern of words in the opening of the Brahma Sutra, which is the source of Vedanta, Atato Brahma Jignasa, now the inquiry into the Absolute. But here we've got now the inquiry into Dharma, into ethical law, norms, how it is to behave in the world. So Dharma is the most important thing in the Mimamsa tradition. And what this Purva Mimamsa says is that these texts, the Vedas, the revelation of the Hindu revelation, if you like, is primarily about injunction, vidhi, do this and don't do that. There's a French philosopher of religion or theorist of religion called René Girard who emphasizes this. He says religions aren't about narrative and stories. The most important thing about religion is prohibition and injunction. You know, the Ten Commandments and so on. Do this, don't do that. So I don't think I don't think that's completely true myself, but I think there's some truth in it. And certainly the Purva Mimamsa has this idea that the most important thing in the Vedic scriptures is injunction, ritual injunction. So you do the sacrifice. Why do you do the sacrifice? Because it says so in the Veda. You have to do it. It's an end in itself. There is the result of sacrifice is heaven, of course, for the practitioner or the person who pays for the sacrifice to be performed, the yajamana. But the reason for doing it is not that. The reason for doing it is injunction, because it's sister in the Veda. So an activity for its own sake. In the later Brahmanas, you get the idea that the sacrifice is necessary to keep the universe going. But the Purva Mimamsa claims that you do the sacrifice because of injunction. And that's enough reason, because the Vedas are eternal and have eternal revelation, and you do it because it says you should. Also, a characteristic of the Purva Mimamsa is the doctrine of Apurva. Apurva is the effects of sacrificial action. So you perform a sacrifice, and it has consequences, and the consequences are called this Apurva, this magical power, if you like, that exists in some sort of cosmic realm, as it were, which is stored up for you, which then has consequences later on. So you do the sacrifice in this world, and that creates this Apurva, which will then come to fruition later on when you die in heaven. So the Apurva, and this could be, some people argue this is a precursor of the idea of karma as well, that karma could come from this idea of Apurva, that what you do has effects later on. But it's strictly confined to the ritual, to ritual here, and the sacrifice in specifically. Okay, so the Purva Mimamsa claims the Veda has no author. It's concerned with Dharma. It says that what's contained in the Veda is injunction. It has this doctrine of Apurva, and it's also realistic and pluralistic, as opposed to the later Vedanta. It says the world is real, and plurality is real. The many is real. It's not an illusion. The world is a realistic system. So there's no mysticism in the Purva Mimamsa. It's antithetical to those kinds of ways of thinking. So it's realist and pluralist, and it's very much concerned with language, and it develops a sophisticated philosophy of language later on, which we probably won't be looking at. Now, one of the important distinctions it makes in the Vedic text is that, okay, you read the Vedas, and one of the exegetical strategies that it develops is to divide the text into sections about knowledge, karma, jnana kanda, and sections about ritual, karma kanda. And it says the sections about ritual are more important than the sections about knowledge, because it's the sections about ritual which are vidhi, which are injunctions to perform certain actions. Now, there is a problem. What is the relation between these two kinds of Vedic texts? And the Mimamsa say that the action sections are more important than the knowledge sections, but the later Vedanta reverses that and say, no, it's the jnana sections are more important than the karma sections. And the problem is, what are the criteria by which you decide which are more important than the others? Later thinkers said, well, you can't make those distinctions, and that all the sections are equally as important to each other. Barker, for example, was wrong about that. Okay, so Purva Mimamsa, a realist system, and there's no non-dualistic sort of mysticism in this tradition, but it's the root, it's the origin of the Vedanta tradition, which flows out from it in response to it. Now, non-dualism, which we find in the earlier Upanishads, is the doctrine that there is only one reality or one substance in the universe. I've spoken about the Purva Mimamsa because I'll be picking it up a bit later on, but I just sort of want to shift to the side now and talk about non-dualism for a moment. And there's only one reality or one substance which is beyond the universe and pervades the universe. Now, non-dualism, Advaita, is terribly important in the history of Indian thinking. And there tends to be two understandings of it. One understanding is that it's a philosophy of being, if you like. It's about the nature of the world. The world is the absolute, and you are the absolute. Tattvamasi, you are that. You are that absolute. So it's about waking up to the truth of that idea that the world is that divisions and distinctions and plurality are ultimately illusory, and the truth of the world is this unitary being which you have to open your eyes to. There's that doctrine. And there's also another kind of non-dualism, which is that the world is an emanation or manifestation of this absolute power, of this unitary force. So the world, to use a later kind of terminology, is a coagulation of this essence, of the essence of the Lord. So they're conceptually distinct, but nevertheless related, and you get both kinds of language being intertwined in the texts. This will become clearer, I think, when we look at Shankara. So the idea is that all appearances are identical with some unitary reality, which is them. It's not that so much it underlies them, but the unitary reality is the appearances. And the earliest expression of this idea is in the Upanishads, where this idea implicitly opposes the dualism of Samkhya and also the impersonalism of Buddhism. So if we go back to sort of the period of, say, 400 BC, by that time you've got the Upanishads have developed, you've got the early Buddhist doctrines developing, and you've got the Samkhya dualists developing. Now, these early non-dualism negates the dualism of Samkhya implicitly. So the Samkhya, do you remember Samkhya from last week or the week before? There were two realities in the universe, the soul and matter, which are eternally distinct. And this doctrine says that, no, that's wrong. There's a one substance in the universe, which is a unitary substance with which everything is identical. And that also implicitly negates the Buddhist impersonalism, which is a realist metaphysics. The world is real, but it has no permanence, no substantiality to it. And indeed, the Buddha's doctrine of no self, he probably has in mind some of the Upanishadic notions of impermanent being. But all of these, all the Upanishads, the Samkhya, and the Buddhist impersonalists all share a denial of the reality of the first person. I sacrifice, I go to the shop, I have a cup of tea. The subject of first person predicates is not the true self, say these. All these systems have that in common, although they vary as to what that true self is. But they all share that denial of the first person. So for the Samkhya, as we saw 2 weeks ago, the first person is a function of matter, is a functioning of prakriti. It's ahankara, that which is one of the tattvas, one of the lower levels of manifestation. But the true self, the purusha, is behind that, beyond language, outside of language, deeper than the I want, or I do, or I sacrifice. And that's common to the Indian soteriology. They all share that denial that the subject of first person predicates is the true self. With some slippage in that. Now Shankara, there was Vedanta before him, of course, but Shankara is, by the time you get to the 8th century CE or AD, he has become identified as the best philosopher of non-dual Vedanta, as the best person who articulates this doctrine of non-dualism, and who places himself within this tradition of the Vedanta, and who responds against the Purva Mimamsa. Now he's from Kerala. He probably is from Kerala. There's a village where he was said to be born, and if you go to the place, there's not much there, so it's not as if they're trying to identify. It's not as if it's a royal palace or anything at the village where he came from. So he probably was born in Kerala. And there's a river lots of legends associated with him. One of the legends is that he was, when he was about 7, he wanted to become a renouncer, but his mother forbade him from becoming a renouncer. Said, no, you can't. You've got to get married and just be normal like everybody else. But he didn't want to do that, so he was bathing in the river, and a crocodile is said to have come up and started to swallow him, and he shouted to his mother, please let me become a renouncer and before I die. And she said, oh yes, okay, you can become a renouncer, because then he would be liberated. And then of course the crocodile lets him go, but he wouldn't relinquish his mother from a promise, so he becomes a royal renouncer. He goes up to Varanasi and teaches there, and the story is that he dies very young, and he dies from dreadful way from an ulcer in his rectum, which was given to him by the evil magic of the Shaiva philosopher Abhinavagupta, which was impossible really, because Abhinavagupta was born several hundred years after Shankara. But anyway, that's a later story. And he's associated with the revival against Buddhism. So he was instrumental in intellectually defeating Buddhism in India. He's got various teachers. One particularly important teacher is Gaudapada. Although he wasn't his initial guru, he was his guru's guru, probably. And he may have written a commentary on that, on Gaudapada's verses. He's also sometimes accused of being a crypto-Buddhist because many of his doctrines are very close to Buddhism. Now his text is Paul Hacker Amayeda, Mayeda argue that his texts fall into four groups. Who is Shankara? If we mean by Shankara is firstly the author of a commentary on the Brahma Sutra. The Brahma Sutra is a key early text that comes after the Vedas, after the Upanishads, which starts Atato Brahma Jignasa, now the inquiry into the Absolute, which reflects the Mimamsa Sutras, now the inquiry into Dharma. So he writes a very important commentary on that. Now, according to Hacker and Mayeda, he also wrote commentaries on the Upanishads, and probably the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad and the Taittiriya Upanishads. He wrote commentaries on those. He wrote a commentary on the Gita, and he wrote an independent work called The Thousand Teachings, the Upadesha Sahasri. Now these scholars exclude various hymns attributed to Shankara, to the goddess, and various other devotional works. Now the only grounds, it seems to me, for excluding him from writing other kind of bhakti or devotional works is that he was a philosopher, so he couldn't possibly have written devotional works. But in the Indian context, I don't think that's the case at all. It's very possible that Shankara did indeed compose some of these other texts, hymns to the goddess and so on. But anyway, who is Shankara? Shankara is the author of the Brahma Sutra of Bhāṣya, the commentary on the Brahma Sutra. And he probably composed these other texts as well that are listed on your handout. He's also attributed with founding an order of monks, the Dashanamis, in four places in India, in Badrinath up in the Himalayas, Dwarka in the west, Puri in the east, Sringeri in the south, and also possibly Kanchipuram, although that's disputed. And there is a strong influence on the later tantric tradition of the Sri Vidya. However, it's been shown recently that the Dashanamis were founded in about the 14th or 15th century, long after Shankara's death, and that they were the Dashanamis were constructed, or their affiliation to Shankara, particularly in connection with royal patronage, that they were aligning themselves with Shankara to give themselves pedigree, to raise their status, and thereby also attracting royal patronage. That's a very interesting development, really. But so the Dashanamis, it's been shown, I think, fairly conclusively now that they were a much later development. Now, Shankara was technically, according to tradition, a Shaiva, but many have argued that he was indeed a Vaishnava, a devotee of Vishnu. And it's probably the case that he was. Paul Hacker argues this, as does Jackie Hurst. For one thing, that nothing Shaiva follows from Shankara, in a sense. So the Vedanta tradition is mainly affiliated to the Vaishnava tradition, as we see with Ramanuja, who responds to Shankara. Why would he respond to Shankara if he wasn't in his own kind of tradition? And also Madhava, a later dualist thinker, who is a Vaishnava as well. So it could well be that Shankara was indeed a Vaishnava, rather than a Shaiva, as tradition has maintained. So that's roughly what we know about him. But what's more important is his philosophy, or his philosophy. And this is what has become particularly important for our understanding of Hinduism in the West. Many associate Hinduism with Shankara's philosophy, indeed. And this is briefly his philosophy on this sheet here. First of all, there is spiritual ignorance, avidya. We all have spiritual ignorance unless you're a liberator or enlightened. And this spiritual ignorance is avidya, is also illusion, maya. And it's caused by the superimposition, or the adhyasa, of what is not the self onto the self. So we project what is not the self, i.e. distinction and division, onto the self, which is unitary. But all knowledge is distorted by adhyasa, by this projection. And this projection, this adhyasa, prevents our seeing the self, the Atman, to be identical with the Absolute, the Brahman. So the Atman, the self, is identical with the Absolute. And that doctrine you get in the early Upanishad, the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, particularly, and the Chandogya Upanishad. So the story of Shweta Ketu and his father. Do you remember that story? Where he says, go and get me a glass of water, put salt in the water, and as the salt pervades the water, so the Brahma pervades the universe. A very famous story. Now, to realize this goal, we need to develop discrimination, viveka, to distinguish the self from what is not the self. Now that idea is actually also found in Samkhya, as we've seen, where liberation occurs through discrimination, through viveka, through distinguishing the self from what is not the self. But whereas in Samkhya, the self is the Purusha, and what is not the self is Prakriti, in Shankara's system, the self is this absolute power, and what is not the self is pure illusion, is illusory. There is nothing which is not the self. In his opening passage on the commentary on the Brahma Sutras, he says, this is Thibaut's translation with some adjustments on the sheet before you, it is a matter of fact that the object and subject, whose respective spheres as the notion of the you and the I, and which are opposed to each other, as much as darkness and light, cannot be identified, nor can their respective attributes. Hence it follows that it is wrong to superimpose upon the subject, whose nature is awareness, chit, and which has for its sphere the notion of I, the object, and its attributes the sphere of the notion of the not I, and vice versa. It is wrong to superimpose the subject and its attribute on the object. So you get this adhyasa, this two-way projection, which is the nature of ignorance and illusion. We project the what is not the self onto the self, and what is the self onto what is not the self. And the removal of this superimposition is the removal of ignorance, and the realization of the self is the realization of the witnessing subject, which is identical with Brahman. The witnessing subject is the true self. And that witnessing subject is identical with this absolute power. And ignorance, says Shankara, arises from limited consciousness which projects unreal distinctions. So I go to this, I'm a sacrificer, I'm a successful Brahmin, I'm a successful warrior, I'm a wife, I'm a mother, I'm a father, I'm a son. All these are social roles which are unreal distinctions, which are projections due to ignorance, which cloud or limit the true self, which is this unlimited consciousness. Well, that's the doctrine. So what's the argument? The argument is that we know this through scripture, through the interpretation of scripture. Now, Shankara's enterprise, his primary purpose, is to show that his Advaita, his non-dual interpretation of sacred scriptures, is correct. So he writes commentaries on the scriptures, writes commentaries on the Brahma Sutra to found his school, he writes commentaries on the Upanishads in order to promote and his own Advaita interpretation of the tradition. And this is more important than any notions of mystical experience in the material. Shankara's primary concern is the correct interpretation of scripture. Now, anubhava, or experience, is there, but it's almost like a trope, it's almost like a rhetoric in his writing. And there's no reference in his work to any personal experience or any religious experience. It's just not on the horizon of his writing. We do get that in later tradition, later texts, where people write about their own love of God and their own personal experience, but it's not a criterion of veracity for Shankara. It's not a means of knowledge. What establishes the truth of his position is not one's own experience, but the authority of scripture. The fact that the Veda is not of human authorship, and the fact that Veda is revealed and tells us these things, Veda reveals the truth of the way things are, and that's the primary means of knowledge. He also says that because the text is not of human authorship, the notion of experience in that text, it doesn't make much sense in a sense, because the text was composed before human beings came on the scene. Now the Probhimamsa have a problem here, because the Veda is, there's all these characters in the Veda, Shvetaketu and his father, and Yajnavalkya, and all these very Maitri, his wife, and all these very colourful characters. Now how do you account for them if the text existed before human beings came into the world? And the Probhimamsa sort of fudges the issue and says actually it doesn't really refer to human beings, but they're figures in order to articulate certain doctrines or truths. So if Shankara says his main focus is on interpretation of the scripture to establish the truth of non-duality. There is a notion of experience in his work, but he doesn't dwell on it, and he doesn't refer to any personal experience. As far as I can see in his writing. Now interpretation is hearing, shravana, hearing the scriptures, manana, thinking about the scriptures, and nididhyasana, meditating upon the scriptures, contemplation of the scriptures. Now it's precisely what nididhyasana means is slightly vague, but does it mean meditation in the sense of rumination on the scriptures as you get in the Western tradition, you ruminate on the sacred texts, Nityo Divina? Does it mean that, or does it mean something more yogic? Does it mean a kind of absorption, like a samadhi? It seems that unclear to me. But certainly shravana and thinking, hearing and thinking, contemplating the scriptures is very, very important. And it's through that process that actual liberation comes. Now let's return for a moment to the Probhimamsa distinction between the knowledge and action, the karma and jnana sections of the texts. Now Shankara's difference with Mimamsa is that the knowledge sections are superior to the karma sections. Only knowledge can liberate a person, not action. As silver is suddenly seen to be a shell, or a snake to be a rope. So, you're walking along a beach. I don't know if any of you have done this, but have you seen, you've picked up money and you found it's a shell. I've said this before. Lots of people have this experience. You walk along the beach, looking for money. Suddenly you pick up coins and you find it's actually shells. That's Shankara's sudden recognition. That sudden recognition, it's not money, it's a shell. That's like liberation. That's the sudden gestalt, the shift of perception. Or the other famous one is that you see a snake in the corner of the hut, of the house, and you go up to it and you find it's actually not a snake but a rope. Because that's adhyasa, that's projection of something which is unreal onto something which is real. So you project the snake onto the rope and you project silver coins onto, because that's your desire, onto the shells, onto the nacre or the mother of pearl. So it's unreal projection. And so knowledge is liberating. So as you see that the silver shells as you see the money is just shells, so you see that the world is the absolute, is Brahman, and the self is Brahman. And that's knowledge that does that, is cognition. There's a jnana, the term jnana is translated as knowledge very often. But in philosophical terms, the usual translation these days is cognition, as a kind of cognition, which makes sense in the case of Shankara. So it's a certain kind of cognition or knowledge which gives liberation, not action. And action, he says, is different from knowledge. To milk a cow, this is Shankara's analogy, to milk a cow takes effort, but to know a cow takes no effort. there's a difference. So this, to be liberated does not take effort. It's effortless. It's a cognition. It's a recognition. A recognition that you are that tattvamasi. And what is this recognition? The recognition is encapsulated in the Mahavakyas, or the great sayings of the Upanishads, such as I am the absolute, aham brahmasmi, this self is the absolute, everything is indeed the absolute, and you are that tattvamasi. So these great sayings reveal the truth. They're the trigger, if you like, for letting you see the truth of the world as Brahman. And Shankara argues for the superiority of the knowledge sections on the basis that liberation, like heaven, is not a thing that can be achieved. You can't achieve liberation through action. Like you can milk a cow, it takes great effort, but you can't achieve liberation. Like you can't know. You can know a cow, and that's effortless. So likewise, liberation is something which happens to you through cognition, through a correct cognition. And you can't cause a correct cognition to occur through an action. So moving on to his notions of liberation then, liberation is not the result of an action. It's not like a right. What is liberation? It's not like a right. He describes it in negatives. It's not the result of an action. How can it be the result of an action? It's not like arriving at a place. It's not like heaven. It's not like going somewhere, arriving at a place. And it's not like dying or losing consciousness. And it's not a future goal or a state. It's not something in the future that you go to. Like the early Buddhist nirvana is the further shore. It's not like that. It's not like going to a place, going to a different place. And liberation exists only in the present. Where can it exist if it's not in the present? It can't be in the future. It's not in the past. It must only exist in the present. And liberation is not an action. And it's not a belief. And it's nothing to do with language, it's outside of language, because language entails the distinction between the subject and object, the subject of language, the subject of predicates. Knowledge, any statement in language entails the distinction between subject and object, Kanen Shankara. And liberation is outside of language. It can't be articulated in words. So you can say it's not this and not that, neti neti, not this, that. But it can't be expressed in words. Okay, what is this liberation then? He says, in answer to that question, he says, what happens to the space inside a pot when the pot breaks. Shankara rhetorically. Nothing happens to the space inside a pot when the pot breaks. Now, Gaudapada, his grandteacher, says actually, really, there's really no liberation. Liberation doesn't really occur. It's not an occurrence. It's an opening your eyes to the truth of the world, which is not an occurrence for Gaudapada. It's like what happens to the light reflected in a dirty mirror when the mirror is cleaned. So if you could say anything about liberation, then it's being sat in its knowing, and it's experiencing one's true self, which is the realization of the self as the absolute, which is the Brahma Samapatti, the Samapatti, the awakening or realization of the self as the absolute. And according to this doctrine, we are always liberated, but just don't know it. Ignorance is, we're ignorant of our liberation, so we have to remove the ignorance, and then we open our eyes and we realize that we're liberated, for Shankara, after this whole Advaita tradition. Knowing is not an action, and so unlike action, doesn't breed further karmic residues. Once you're liberated, you can't get more karma, and you stop rebirth. A later advice in a younger contemporary, Mandana Mishra, says that liberation can be achieved by meditation. You practice meditation and you achieve liberation. But Shankara denies that. He says, no, how can you... Meditation has no possible function because it's an action. Liberation is not the result of an action, and so can't be reached through any activity. So you can meditate and you blew in the face, but it won't result in liberation, because the action meditation is an action. Okay, how is liberation achieved? Liberation is achieved through recognition, through cognition of the truth of the great sentences, the Mahavakyas. Tattvamasi, Aham Brahmasmi. The existential realization of those truths gives you liberation. But even the great sentences, even the Mahavakyas, are ultimately false. Even though one can be liberated through them, as you can be killed, says Shankara, through fear of an illusory snake. The fear of a snake, which isn't real, can kill you. So the Mahavakyas, although illusory, can liberate you. It's full of these exquisite paradoxes, these doctrines. There is some concession to Bhakti for Shankara. He says he actually introduces a notion of two levels of truth. There's this higher level of truth in which we're all liberated, and there's no such thing as liberation, and we just have to wake up to that truth. But for those of us who can't attain the heights of that kind of understanding, we can be devoted to a personal Lord. There's Ishvara is there for that. We can be devoted to this being with qualities, but the absolute, which is the self, has no qualities, is beyond language and beyond all qualities, and you can't say anything about it. Okay, liberation then. What happens at liberation? When avidya is removed, two or three kinds of actions are made inoperative. There are residues stored which have not come to fruition in this life. They lose their power like burned seeds. And actions still to be performed in this life no longer bind you. So Jivan Mukti, Shankara has this notion of Jivan Mukti, liberation in life. You can be liberated now, here and now, in the present time. Because Brahman is nowhere else other than in the here and now. Prarabdha karma is the doctrine that karma to be enacted in the present lifetime. So anything that happens to us in this lifetime is our prarabdha karma, our actions which were created in past lives which are now coming to fruition in this life. That's called prarabdha. Now that doesn't get... Jivan Mukti doesn't get rid of that. That carries on going. As an arrow, Shankara using an arrow in flight, uses the image of an arrow in flight. There's an arrow once released from the bow. You can't do anything about it. It just has to fulfill its function and go to it then. So prarabdha karma has to unfold itself in the present life. But liberation gets rid of what he calls sanchitta, or accumulated or storehouse karma, karma which is stored for later fruition. The great storehouse of karma which we all carry around with us is eradicated. As a pile of cotton, you put a fire flame to a pile of cotton, it just burns it up in a flash. So that sanchitta karma is burned up with liberation. And there's agami, future karma, karma created in the present lifetime, which will come to fruition in a later life, that too is eradicated. So the jiva mukta, the one liberated in life, cannot accumulate future karma anymore. So you're just winding, as another image used in Buddhism, which is also used by Shankara, the potter with a wheel just lets go of the wheel of the pot and just winds down until it stops. So there's no more rebirth for the one who is liberated in life. So prarabdha and agamin karma are eradicated in jivan mukti. Now, so for the jivan mukta, behaviour is no longer an action, because action needs desire, and the jivan mukta has eradicated desire. And the jivan mukta simply works out his prarabdha karma in this life, and no longer acts, and simply unfolds prarabdha karma, because it is in a state of liberation. His behaviour is technically no longer action, because he's beyond action. He's just going about in the world. He's just unfolding his prarabdha karma. And from the perspective of higher truth, this paramartika satya, this higher truth, supreme truth, the jivan mukta, the one liberated in life, is liberated and incapable of ordinary knowledge and action. But from a lower standpoint, from the vyavaharika, the everyday standpoint, he is a renouncer, a world renouncer. So Shankara makes this interesting move of identifying the jivan mukta with the sannyasin, with the liberated sadhu, with the last stage of the ashrama system, if you remember. So it's a fairly radical monism that Shankara presents. And it's interesting because he's so keen on upholding the values of Dharma, the orthodox Brahmanical values. And yet, within his doctrine is this implicit rupture of those values through claiming that liberation in life, you go beyond all Vedic values. But he nevertheless is very keen on maintaining the Vedic values. And so he does it through saying, actually, the jivan mukti is identified with the fourth stage of life, the fourth ashrama. So you have to be a renouncer to achieve this jivan mukti. Now, there's a moral problem in monism, as Zeno pointed out, R.C. Zeno, that if there's only one reality in the universe, how do you differentiate between good and bad actions? How can some actions be good, virtuous, and some actions non-virtuous or bad? And that is a problem for monism. And R.C. Zeno wrote a very interesting book, Our Savage God, in which he argued that the doctrines of monism end up with the justification for murder, for example, that you can't differentiate savage actions from good actions because there's only one reality and that all actions are the same. Zeno was interesting. He, in that book, Our Savage God, he wrote, he became obsessed towards the end of his life with Charles Manson, who was a mass murderer in the 60s in California. And he went to see him in prison. And he got back to his flat, his rooms in Oxford, and he smoked his cigarette, and he let it go out, and he set fire to his rooms. And he said that was Manson's evil eye turning on him. But he went a bit mad, I think, probably Zeno did, but that's a very interesting book. He brings up this moral problem of monism in that book. How can you justify moral actions if there's only one reality in the universe? How can you differentiate between good and bad actions if there's only one reality? But now Shankara tried to do that. He would have been horrified by Zeno's claim. And indeed try to separate his own doctrines from those of other immoral practitioners who rejected the Veda, such as the Buddhists. because for Shankara, the Jivan Mukta, the one liberated in life, cannot act immorally, even though technically beyond Dharma. There is nevertheless a moral constraint operating on the Jivan Mukta. Although metaphysically there can be no justification for that, because the Jivan Mukta is beyond all discrimination, beyond all differentiation. Now, well, we've got to stop good evidence. The arguments, let's have a look at his arguments. In the Brahma Sutra Bhasha, you've got let's just look at the argument. Let's look at the first argument. Brahman is known already, since it is the self of everyone. This is one argument in the first commentary on the first sutra. That self which is always known must be presupposed in all experience as the subject. Thus the self which is the subject is always the subject and never the object of experience. We never have ourselves as the object of our experience, as Shankara. Therefore any notion of the self is that of an object cannot be of the real self. Objectifying notions such as I, me, body, I want a drink, are superimposed on the real self. So all those objectifications in language, like I go to the cinema or whatever, are not the real self, are superimposed on the real self. And the real self is beyond objectifying notions and beyond all language and concepts. Anyway, I'll leave you to read the rest of the... we haven't done causation. We'll perhaps do that briefly next time. Any questions or points before we wind up? Do go if you have to. Karen.
Some of this sounds a lot like some of the Sufi traditions. Like, is there Arabic in it?
I don't know. It might not do. I think it could be a bit early, actually. It could be the other way around. The Sufis might well get it from. Might well get it from there. There was lots of interactions with the Sufis in North India.